Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm speaking with Rebecca Zitlow, author of the book, The Forgotten Emancipator, James Mitchell Ashley and the Ideological Origins of Reconstruction. Rebecca, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We're glad to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Sure. I grew up in southern Indiana. My father was a professor. My mother was involved in local politics, always very interested in politics. I went to college in New York City. I went to law school, and then I worked for a few years as a legal services lawyer in the South Side of Chicago, in a very poor, one of the poorest neighborhoods in the country. Almost all my clients were Black, many of whom had come up from Mississippi in the Great Migration. And then I became a law professor, but that experience of my time in practice and also growing up and interested in politics has really had an impact on my scholarly interests as a constitutional law professor.
I think that comes across very well in your book because it does contain this fascinating intersection of law and politics and shows how tightly interwoven the two are and how you really have to think of them in tandem. What was it that led you to write this book?
Well, I started thinking about this. So my interest in poverty law and racial justice sort of combined I started paying attention to the Reconstruction Amendments, the Reconstruction era, which is, of course, the post-Civil War era when we amended our Constitution to abolish slavery and involuntary servitude and make rights enforceable against state governments. And what I really became interested in the 13th Amendment, which is the amendment which abolished slavery and involuntary servitude, because it does contain elements of both racial equality, a promise of racial equality for the freed former slaves, and also economic empowerment for workers. As for James Ashley, there's a kind of a fun story with that regard. I was at a conference on Reconstruction in Philadelphia, and a friend of mine from law school, a very close friend, said to me, "Oh, if you're interested in the Reconstruction Congress, you should learn about my great-great-granddaddy." And he pulled out a book and he showed me this picture of James Ashley, and I had never heard of Ashley before. And because law professors, mostly when they write about Reconstruction, focus on the 14th Amendment. That's the amendment that it has some rights in it, due process, equal protection, privileges or immunities of citizenship that are enforceable against state governments. And that's mostly what the courts, including the Supreme Court, has enforced in sort of trying to enforce the promise of Reconstruction. They haven't until recently really paid that much attention to the 13th Amendment. And James Ashley, he was tied to the 13th Amendment. He was a radical member of the Reconstruction Congress. He was anti-slavery from the time he was very young, a teenager. He was involved in the Underground Railroad. He ran for Congress at a pretty young age, one of the founders of the Republican Party. And all along, he was extremely radical in terms of both his interest in racial justice and economic justice. And so I just became more and more interested in him. I started doing research and found that he was really a very important member of Reconstruction Congress that most people had not heard of, other than, you know, historians of the Reconstruction era.
Yeah, there does seem to be a real shame that his contribution has really been overlooked. And you point out that the reason for this is that a lot of his personal papers were destroyed prior to his death, whether by him or deliberately or accidentally. You say we can't say for certain. Your approach to understanding his life, though, I thought was especially fascinating, because what you provide your readers is basically this study of his ideas and how they fit into the thought of his times. And I thought it was especially illuminating because you show what brought Ashley to that point, not just in terms of a dislike of slavery, but you situate it within the intellectual and legal milieu of the period. You're talking about issues like free labor. You're talking about, you know, the issues of anti-slavery constitutionalism, and not just what these ideas were, but then you set it up for how Ashley contributes to them over the course of his career.
Yeah, we don't know very much about Ashley's private life because his papers were destroyed. There's a few letters here and there, but we really don't know that much. But what we do know is the public record of what he said and what he did, both when he was running for Congress and then when he was in Congress. That public record, it's what's especially important for understanding what the Constitution means. It's actually more important than whatever he thought, you know, and whatever he's told his friends or whatever, because this is what he was saying out on the stump, right? And this is what he was saying, you know, what the 13th Amendment means, what it means, why slavery should be abolished. And that really helps us to understand what the Constitution means. And also, as you said, I'm really interested in how those ideas developed within the politics of the movement, the anti-slavery movement, and also both the anti-slavery movement and then the burgeoning workers' rights movement in the United States. So one of the things that distinguishes Ashley's from some of the other members of the Reconstruction Congress that at least law professors know more about, such as John Bingham, the chief author of the 14th Amendment, is that Ashley was a former Democrat. He had been part of the Democratic Party and the sort of the popular worker-focused populism of President Andrew Jackson. And that was an important part of the way he thought about the Constitution and the way he thought about slavery as being not just about racial oppression, but actually about oppression of workers. And so, and that really is very apparent in his, what he said publicly.
I was wondering if you could start us off by talking a bit about what you mean by anti-slavery constitutionalism, because as you explained, there is a lot going on there that really is important when we talk about the Ashley's involvement with Constitution and constitutional law in Congress. What did you mean by that phrase, and what was that thinking of the time, given that you had a legal culture, a lot of legal assumptions that about how slavery was something that was, you know, regarded as guaranteed in law?
Yes, and that's actually something historians are talking a lot about these days, the question of, you know, the extent to which our original Constitution was a pro-slavery document. Those who argue that it was a pro-slavery document, they cite to Madison's notes from the Constitutional Convention, James Madison, where he talks about the fact that they needed to make certain compromises in order to protect slavery. They point to measures in the Constitution, such as, of course, the Fugitive Slave Clause, with the Three-Fifths Clause, which counted slaves as three-fifths of a person, et cetera. A part of the Constitution that's prohibited Congress from banning the importation of slaves from until a certain date. But I think when we look and see what happened, of course, is that there was slavery at the time of the founding, and then it continued to exist through the Civil War. But there were also, within the movement, the anti-slavery movement, there were two camps. There were the Garrisonian abolitionists who said, the Constitution is completely and utterly flawed. I don't have the quote in front of me right now, but it's something like a compact with the devil and a deal in hell is what Garrison called the Constitution. But then there were this other group of, and Garrison said, we shouldn't even be involved in politics at all because the entire system is flawed and corrupt. But then there were other people who said, wait, we need to get involved in politics because that's the only way we're going to end slavery. And look, there's a lot in this Constitution that looks like it's against slavery. So, for example, the Due Process Clause prohibits the taking of life, liberty without due process of law. There's a Privileges or Immunities Clause that says states could recognize free blacks as citizens, and they would have protections as citizens. The Declaration of Independence with its promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so, and they argued both in courts, but mostly in the political realm, that the Constitution was actually anti-slavery. And they pointed out that the so-called Fugitive Slave Clause doesn't mention slaves, nor does any other provision, including the Three-Fifths Clause. The word slave was not in the Constitution until the 13th Amendment, with its language that abolishing slavery. And so they said, if you just look at the text of the Constitution, you can see it doesn't say anything about slavery. It doesn't protect slavery. And there are parts in it that contain protections for rights that mean that it's unconstitutional. Now, they made some of these arguments in courts and they lost. But they made these arguments in the political realm, and they gained a lot of traction in terms of support for the anti-slavery movement. And in fact, even the platform of the Republican Party had a very moderate version of anti-slavery constitutionalism, but it was very influential during those days, the 1840s and 1850s, you know, leading up to the Civil War.
When does Ashley start to speak or write about these ideas in a way that suggests that he's embraced them? Is it during that period in the 1840s and 1850s, or is it reflected more in his later writings?
Oh, definitely in the 1850s. I mean, he was born, we think, we're not sure exactly when, but we think it's 1824. So he was, he wasn't even, really came an adult right in the late 1840s, early 1850s. And he was giving speeches where he was arguing that slavery was completely unconstitutional from early days. One argument that I didn't mention earlier that was actually very important to Ashley was that he argued that slavery violated natural law, principles of natural law, and that those principles should be enforceable through law. He was also motivated by his religious beliefs. He thought it was completely immoral. Slavery was completely immoral. That makes him more like the Garrisonians. But he, as I said, he got involved in politics. He ran for office. He really got involved in 1856, where he was campaigning for another someone else who was running for Congress. And he gave these speeches with these very broad views of rights back then in 1856. This is sort of the first written record that we have of this.
I thought your discussion of anti-slavery constitutionalism was really interesting, but I was especially fascinated by the fact that you had this discussion about free labor, because free labor is something that, it's associated with the Jacksonian movement, with the Democratic Party, and it's something that I had not really seen as well developed in terms of how, anti-slavery ideas stem from that until you explain how it breaks down and how Ashley embodies it. Because as you point out, and you've already referenced, he starts out as a Democrat. He doesn't start out as a Whig or a Free Soiler or a Republican. He starts out as a Democrat, which is the party that during this period is increasingly becoming more of a pro-slavery or anti-slavery, shall we say, party. So could you explain a bit what free labor was and how Ashley drew from that a critique against slavery, especially when there were so many Democrats who were very pro-free labor, but who or labor theory of value, but who never really connected that with opposition to slavery?
Well, so the fact is that slavery was a system of exploitation of labor. It was, of course, also extremely racially, our country was actually pretty unique in terms of the racialized nature of slavery and the cruelty of treatment of slaves, in part because of the dehumanization, you know, the use of racial racism and white supremacy to dehumanize people who were enslaved. But it is also true that that all of this ideology contributed to the exploitation of labor. And at the same time, in the North, we have this evolution, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, where at the turn of the, you know, in 1800, our economy was primarily artisanal farmers, people that at least could expect, they would hope someday that they might own their own farm. Over time, they start to realize that they, you know, that the only work they can find is at a factory, is for wages, and they start to make, especially the factory workers start to make a connection. Not all of them, so, as you point out, many of the Democrats were pro-slavery, and many of the people in the labor movement were not interested in slavery, or at least they said, we need to solve the problem of the worker here before we worry about the slaves in the South. But some people recognized that there was a whole continuum here of unfree labor. And that as long as, for example, in the North, there was a practice of indentured servitude that was extremely common in the colonial days and the early years of our country, including into the 19th century, where people were bound to their masters for terms of years. And couldn't leave their master over disputes over wages, conditions of work, and such. And some people started to make this connection that they realized that the existence of slavery sort of brought down lowered the bottom in terms of both conditions and wages of workers throughout the country. The fact that there were enslaved people meant it justified practices such as indentured servitude and really poor treatment of workers in all employment situations. And so that there began and there grew over time an anti-slavery movement within the labor movement. And one of the great stories is of the Lowell Mills, the women that worked at the cotton mills in Lowell, Massachusetts. Very strongly, they signed anti-slavery petitions. They argued that they were wage slaves, so they identified with slaves in the South, but they also were against slavery anywhere. And this began to spread. It was spread to Ohio. There were a lot of people, and they were the ones, of course, that influenced Ashley.
So Ashley himself is not a wage laborer over the course of his career, although he has a remarkably varied pre-political career. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain some of the things he did and how they inform our understanding of his perspective on labor and slavery in American society.
Well, that's a good point, because he grew up, he didn't have an awful lot of money. He didn't come from a wealthy family, but he aspired to be kind of an entrepreneur. So he grew up in Southern Ohio. Uh, he, he moved to Toledo, Ohio, in his early 20s, because in part because he had been involved in the Underground Railroad, and there was it was kind of a dangerous thing to do, and there was more anti-slavery sentiment in Toledo, but also because I think he thought he might have some economic opportunities. So he tried to open a pharmacy. The pharmacy failed. He tried to work as a journalist, and that didn't really work out either. So he actually kind of found his career in politics, honestly. He wasn't really successful at anything else until he started getting involved in politics. And so maybe some of his struggles and economic struggles were part of the reason why he identified with workers, that he had, you know, he and many of, you know, the former Democrats that joined the Republican Party and that, you know, formed a wing of the Democrat, of the of kind of the radical wing of the Republican Party, they saw slavery as this oligarchy, a feudal system, where there was a lord, you know, presiding over the slaves, and they thought that was fundamentally un-American. They also, I forgot to mention earlier, but they cited the Republican, the clause that guarantees a Republican form of government. So I think that, you know, it's clear that Ashley identified not with the Lord, right, but with the workers that were working for the Lord. And maybe it was partly because of his sort of economic struggles early in his life. But that's pure speculation, because we really don't know.
You describe his entry into politics, and it was very fascinating because he seemed to be there at these very critical moments, and he connected with the right people. He connected with Salmon Chase, who was this rising political force in Ohio, very staunchly anti-slavery. He attends one of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which I just thought was such a fascinating detail.
Yeah.
And then he's there. He witnesses the trial of John Brown. I mean, he seems to be you know, at these points at which you're really seeing history turning, and he's really has this interesting connection with these very key players. What ultimately leads him to pursue a political career, and how does he get into office?
Well, I think that it appears that when he was young, he was very close friends with a family, a Quaker family, very strongly anti-slavery, who also had a really good library, and Ashley would read all these treatises, anti-slavery treatises and other, and so that's what he really got him interested in it. And I agree with you, it's amazing how much he traveled back in those days, because he traveled to Washington, D.C. He was there at the inauguration of William Henry Harrison. He went to the 1844 Democratic Convention, at which he left disgusted because the convention nominated the pro-slavery Van Buren.
Polk.
Yes, thank you, James Polk, instead of Van Buren from New York. He traveled to he saw the Lincoln-Douglas debate. He campaigned for Lincoln. He went to the very first convention where the Republican Party was founded. And as you mentioned, he became a protege early on of Salmon Chase, and that was crucial to his success, making connections and such. But he really, really got out. He really, and so when he made all these connections, and I think that he really impressed people with his, both his personality, his speaking style, and they said, well, you know, you should run for Congress yourself. And so he did. And he won the first time that he ran in 1858.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And it was really interesting to think about how he gets into politics. I mean, he only serves in Congress for a decade, but
yes,
it's such an important decade. And you point out that he's elected in 1858, but at that time, the Congress in which he served wouldn't meet for another year, so he has a year to get there. So he doesn't really start until 1859. And you have all these events going on at that time. You're on the eve of the election of 1860. You have the election take place. You have the response to the election. What was his response to what was going on nationally as the debate on slavery was really reaching a boiling point?
Well, he really understood that it was, you know, that the debate was reaching a boiling point. As you mentioned, he went to the trial of John Brown, and he wrote back a report that '68, where he basically said, you know, this is a harbinger of things to come. Here we go. Men may talk as they will, but I tell you this. There is a smoldering volcano burning beneath the crust, ready to burst forth at any moment. And an enemy to peace of almost every hearthstone is lurking at the heart of the apparently submissive lashed slave. And it basically predicted, you know, that the Civil War was going to come. Gets into Congress. As you said, he starts in Congress in 1859. And of course, next year, Lincoln is elected. And from the very beginning, Ashley, I think in part because of all the campaigning he did for so many other Republicans, he's very well liked. He's very well respected. He's elected to the Committee on the Territories. And at that time, slavery in the territories was the number one issue. It's really the issue that was sort of the sparked the conflagration, disputes over slavery in the territories. And he was poised and ready. And as soon as the war broke out, he said, this war is going to end slavery, which wasn't what people thought at the time, right? And that's not the way Lincoln framed it. It was a war to save the Union, of course, to protect the Union. But from the very beginning, Ashley did everything he could to make sure that the war would actually bring about the end of slavery.
So could you describe some of the measures that he was supporting and also how he was dealing with the fact that while he was convinced the war was going to end slavery, that was not the position that the Republican president in the White House was adopting on it? And how did he deal with the fact that he was getting that resistance from his own party leader?
Well, and so there was always a lot of tension between Ashley and other radical members such as Thaddeus Stevens, Charles Sumner, and the Republican Party, and Lincoln, because Lincoln really was moderate. Lincoln, for example, one of the examples, and this also was a difference between Ashley and Salmon Chase, Ashley argued that slavery was unconstitutional everywhere, but Lincoln and Chase argued only that Congress had the power to prohibit slavery in territories, but not in the existing states. Measures that Ashley proposed included supporting General Benjamin Butler at the very beginning of the war when slaves escaped across northern lines. Some of the Union generals just returned the slaves to their masters, but General Butler said, no, you're contraband of war. We're confiscating you from the Confederates and you're now free. And Ashley supported that. Eventually, over a couple of years later, Congress enacted a law that authorized that practice. But from the very beginning, Ashley saw this as a very important In fact, he traveled to the battlefield to meet Butler, and he saw this as a very important development. Another thing he did in 1862, which was very early on the war, and it was very not clear who was going to win, Ashley introduced the first, what he called, reconstruction measure. What would we do once we win the war to in these slave states? And the reconstruction, his bill would have said that all the southern states that seceded were now conquered territories. The federal government could do whatever it wanted. And what they would do would be end slavery, confiscate land, give land to free slaves, give voting rights to freed slaves. And so it was all very, very sort of ahead of its time. Eventually, some of this happened right during after the war, during Reconstruction, including voting rights, though, of course, never the confiscation of land.
And that takes us a little ahead of the story. We'll get to that in a little bit. But so okay. he's adopting this, he's putting these very radical measures forward as legislation, and legislation doesn't really go anywhere. How does he then become tied to or involved with the passage of the 13th Amendment? And maybe you can start by setting up the context, explaining how it was that the 13th Amendment came to be a real possibility in Congress and nationally.
Yeah, so a couple of things leading up to that. One was the abolition of slavery in the District of Columbia. And that up until and during and the beginning of the Civil War, slavery was still legal in the District of Columbia, which is, of course, where the Capitol was. And Ashley was one of the, as his position at that time of chair of Committee on the Territories, one of the people that spearheaded this effort to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia. But that was the abolition of slavery in the District of Columbia included payments for to the slave owners for the slaves, which was something that Ashley strongly opposed, but saw as understood it was necessary in order to get it in across into Congress, right? Mm-hmm. But then the next thing, of course, that happens is the Emancipation Proclamation, and when Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation as a war effort, saying that slaves in conquered territories would be free, that makes the Civil War really into a war to end slavery. And so then taking the next step in abolishing slavery everywhere seemed a sort of natural progression from that. That's at least what Ashley and the other people that supported the 13th Amendment argued. This horrible institution of slavery is the only reason why the Confederacy exists and survives, and it has to go. And our country can't continue with any legal slavery. And so, of course, the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery everywhere in the country. And Ashley was one of the first. He was the first person to propose the 13th Amendment, although the language he used wasn't what ended up in the bill. That language was from Lyman Trumbull, also a former Democrat from Illinois in the Senate.
So the amendment initially goes through the Senate, and they ratify it, and then it goes to the House. And this is something that some listeners might be familiar with because it's fictionalized in the movie Lincoln. And as you point out there, Ashley is a character in it, but he's misrepresented. It's a great performance by David Constable, but
yes.
he's portrayed as having a different position than was the case. What was his role in getting the amendment through the House, and how does he go about achieving its passage?
And that's where he really becomes an ally of Abraham Lincoln, because Lincoln ran for president that fall on the platform of ending slavery, as did Ashley. Many others did not, because even in the fall of 1864, it was not clear which way the war was going to go, but they both did. And when he was elected, Lincoln took this as a mandate, as did Ashley. And the North the Union had started winning battles and things were looking better. And of course, we're coming on the the eventual victory of the Union in the following spring. So, but it still was going to take a lot of work to get the amendment through Congress. And Ashley and Lincoln worked together to lobby the reluctant members of Congress. And that's portrayed, as I say, not accurately, but portrayed in the movie. And I think of it as if you know about how the 1964 Civil Rights Act got through Congress and passed the filibuster with Senator Hubert Humphrey working with President Lyndon Johnson. It was the same kind of thing. They were working hand in hand. They were making whatever arguments that they could. There were certainly some log rolling type, you know, promises made at the time, and Ashley, but he, you know, they got the votes, and Ashley presided over the vote in Congress in January of 1865 in the House of Representatives. He gave a speech explaining what he believed the 13th Amendment was about and the reason for it, and then you know, of course, they voted, the House of Representatives voted in favor of it. And the rest is history.
The rest is indeed history. But then, and you go on to explain, you know, that's not the end of it. It's not enough simply to end slavery. He then, with the passage, you have the end of the war closely following upon the heels of that. And then you enter the period of Reconstruction. And as you've already explained, he has been working, he's been thinking about Reconstruction. He's been proposing legislation before there was even really a name for it. So what is his attitude about the emancipation of the slaves post-ratification? And what is he doing in Congress with regard to Reconstruction?
Well, the most important thing to Ashley was that the former slaves should have voting rights. He really and truly believed that the only way that Reconstruction was going to work was for former slaves to be full 100% citizens and to be able to vote on the people that would represent them. As you mentioned, the 13th Amendment alone was not sufficient. The Southern states did ratify because they knew they just didn't have a choice. But they resisted the end of slavery in every way. Southern state legislatures enacted laws known as Black Codes, which deprived freed slaves of all basic rights, including the right to contract, required them to enter into essentially indentured servitude, you know, long-term contracts with their masters over which they would have no control. So, you know, contained provisions that if Black people were walking on the highway, and if they weren't working, that they could be arrested and forced to work. That was even though there was the 13th Amendment. So it required, at the very least, legislation to enforce the 13th Amendment. So the 1866 Civil Rights Act really directed at those Black codes, making it clear that freed slaves had fundamental rights, including the right to contract, the same as white people. That really was geared at protecting the rights of those freed slaves, and especially their right to engage in contracts for their labor on fair terms with their former masters or with other people, because, of course, they weren't really all that interested in working for their former masters. But a lot of them ended up having to work, you know, on the same plantations for their former masters. But then the next thing is, as I say, Ashley and the other radicals, such as Thaddeus Stevens, who's portrayed in that movie that we were talking about as a real radical that he was, and Ashley was like him, they thought the most important thing, as I said, was the right to vote. And Ashley went out to California. He gave speeches in favor of his vision of Reconstruction, where Blacks would be treated as 100% equal citizens with the right to vote. And that's really what he focused on the rest of his time in Congress with regard to Reconstruction.
And yet at the height of Reconstruction, just as Congress is starting to take it over, Ashley loses re-election. Why does he lose re-election at this point? And to what degree is it connected to his prominence in the Reconstruction debate?
Well, he had over the years, he was very, he had very strong beliefs. He had, very, was very outspoken. He defended some people, including, you know, powerful people in his district, especially the editor of the paper, the Toledo Blade, that constantly published negative articles about him. And he also got involved in the failed effort to impeach President Johnson. So Lincoln was assassinated. Johnson, a pro-slavery, well, not pro-slavery, but a Southerner who wanted to allow the South to return to pretty much what it had been before, becomes president, and it makes people, Johnson tried to impede every single Reconstruction measure. He vetoed every bill that was passed through Congress, including the 1866 Civil Rights Act. And Ashley is one of the leaders in the first effort to impeach Johnson, and he goes a little overboard in terms of the allegations he's making against Johnson. It's sort of unclear, and his biographer tries to say, well, he didn't really argue this, but it appears there's some evidence that Ashley thought that Johnson had something to do with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And so that hurt his credibility. And also he continues to be extremely radical. And around that 67, 68, Congress is starting to become a little more moderate in terms of what it's expecting from Reconstruction. And Ashley, like Stevens, still extremely radical, sort of really too radical for the Republican Party by 1868.
Now, I would have understood had you ended the book around that point, but you then talk about his post-congressional career and his post-congressional life. And I thought it was interesting because you take a lot of the ideas that you see in Ashley's congressional advocacy and you show how they play out both in his subsequent time as governor of Montana Territory and then also in his subsequent business career. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain in a bit more detail what I'm talking about here, but also what do you feel that reveals about Ashley himself as a person and his beliefs?
Well, so we were talking earlier about the free labor strand of the anti-slavery movement and its potential for all workers, so that abolishing slavery and involuntary servitude would raise the floor for all workers and help all workers. And in the early measures of Reconstruction, the ones Ashley was behind, the 13th Amendment, the 66 Civil Rights Act, the 67 Anti-Peonage Act, really reflects that view that this is about both race equality and economic equality. And after Ashley leaves Congress, he continues to advocate for that vision, what he called the vision of the old guard. And he's appointed a governor of Montana, where he speaks out against the Chinese system of coolie labor, where Chinese immigrants were brought to the United States to work to build the railroads and were treated really like indentured servants, almost like slaves. And Ashley speaks out against this. So he continues to make these free labor arguments. And the reason why I thought it was important to talk about this was because, as I said, in Congress, the Republican Party becomes more moderate, becomes more pro-business over the years, very much in focused on developing the West, building railroads, et cetera, and over the years becomes the pro-business party that we recognize today. What Ashley's tried to continue to do is an example of the road not taken. You know, if the party had really continued to focus on enforcing both workers' rights and rights against racial equality. One of the things that the labor movement, and actually loses his job pretty quickly as governor of Montana, because it turns out a lot of the people who lived in Montana were former Confederates that had moved up there when things started to go badly in the war, and they didn't like him at all. So they complained, and President Grant actually removed him. He comes back and he builds a business, and this time it's fairly successful, at least through in the early years, and that's building a railroad between Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Toledo, and that at one point goes out as far as to Chicago. And I can say that, having lived in Toledo for many years, I sure wish that railroad was still there. It's been really nice, both to go up to Ann Arbor and to go to Chicago. So anyway, he starts to advocate the sort of one wing of the labor movement, sort of labor republicanism, which was this view that workers should be part of the ownership of the means of production and be involved in the running of businesses. And Ashley gave to his workers the kind of benefits that that we sort of expect, or we used to expect from work today, such as a pension. And so he basically has progressive policies towards his workers as the owner. Now he's on the other side, right? Now he is the owner of a business, but he's still using progressive policies towards his workers.
It is interesting to see how, you know, how deeply felt that that his views were, that he was willing to put them into practice, even at a time when nobody would have really, most people wouldn't have held it against him if he had gone the more, the more traditional capitalist route of, you know, treating workers like parts that could be exchanged and sending in strike breakers and Pinkertons and whatnot. And yet he remains true to that, you know, up through the point where he retires. And you have I thought that the part at the end where you talk about how he's honored by African-Americans for what he did is as a real statement of just how, not just how he was viewed by many of his peers, but also that contrast between how at the end of his life, he has no less than a person than Frederick Douglass lauding him. And yet how that contrast with what you point out at the beginning of your book about how he subsequently then ends up getting forgotten.
Yeah. I think it's a very moving scene. There was a man named Benjamin Arnett, who was the head of the Afro-American League of Tennessee, who happened, he was a AMC, African Methodist Episcopal Church, right, that was formed in the midst of the 19th century. And actually, one of the things that Ashley did, he helped to found that church in Toledo, which was an amazing thing. And that was back in the early days, in his early life. That was an amazing thing for a white person to do, to be involved in that sort of social movement and help to found a church like that. So anyway, Benjamin Arnett was at the vote on the 13th Amendment, and Ashley really impressed him. And years later, we're getting ready for the Columbian Exposition in Chicago, and Arnett contacts Ashley and says, "We want to publish a book of your speeches, and we want to honor you at this exposition." And so they actually sent him his speeches, they published them, and they honored him on a day at the exposition that was devoted to African Americans. Something like, I think it was 9,000 people were at the presentation. This was in 1892. So it was many years later, it was the year before Ashley died, that he got this. And as you mentioned, Frederick Douglass wrote the introduction, in which he calls him one of the true supporters of liberty, one of the most important figures in the anti-slavery movement, which is an incredible tribute. And so that legacy is there. But what happens? So then, the next question is, why is he forgotten? And as you were saying, the answer is that the history of Reconstruction has been politicized as Reconstruction itself. As you know, you're a historian. History can be politicized, and that's especially true when it comes to the history of Reconstruction. So in the early 20th century, the principal school of history, known as the Dunning School, was dominated by Southern historians who sort of wanted to rewrite the history of slavery and Reconstruction to make it sound better for the South, to justify essentially the continued exploitation of Black labor through the Jim Crow system and the treatment of Blacks as second-class citizens. And they just referred to the members of the Reconstruction Congress in the most derogatory terms. I mean, that's where we get the idea of General Grant, Ulysses Grant, as being a drunkard who didn't really know what he was doing. Really blasphemous stuff. And Ashley just kind of drops out then. In the 18th, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say in the 60s and the 70s, there's a whole new movement of historians such as Michael S. Benedict and Eric Foner that start to rewrite the history of Reconstruction consistently with what really happened there. And that's when we start getting, you know, some recognition of the members of the Reconstruction Congress. But they still don't get nearly enough recognition.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. I'm working on a couple of projects that sort of build on this. One is a sort of a multi-article project about what the right to contract and the right to free labor mean for workers since the 13th Amendment established that right. And in particular, I'm working on a piece about the gig economy workers now and how what this means to our current economy, our labor economy. And I'm also working on a project about fugitive slaves and their impact on this whole story that we were talking about as constitutional actors. They played a crucial role as catalysts for constitutional change and inspiring people like Ashley to get involved in the anti-slavery movement. And so that's the other thing I'm working on.
Well, those both sound like excellent projects. I wish you the best with them.
Thank you.
Rebecca Zitlow, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.